Hi, Heather. Are you there?
I am.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad our connection worked here. So I want to tell you guys a little bit about Heather before we get started. It's Heather Sansom, and she's a personal trainer, speaker, author, clinician, and, of course, a lifelong rider. And she owns Equifit.com, equestrian fitness, and maybe I can get her to tell us a little bit about that more when we're done chatting here. And she specializes in fitness for equestrians. And being a baby boomer myself, of course, I've got a bunch of questions about fitness to ask her, and I'm sure you guys too do too. So we're going to jump right in with some of these questions. And the first thing I want to ask you, Heather, is I ride 6 days a week. Doesn't riding regularly keep you fit?
Well, Jane, riding definitely keeps you healthy and fit as compared to a sedentary lifestyle, that's for sure. But I'm sure that you've noticed that the way your body works now isn't the same as it did when you were 20.
Yeah.
And in fact, because riding, like any sport, uses your muscles and your body in a particular way and not others, it's kind of like your athletic vocabulary for range of motion diminishes. So I'm sure you've seen or been familiar with an old horseman who might be fine on a horse and get off and walk bow-legged.
Right.
And so this stiffness that you just get with age or with repetitive use of your body in a particular way without adequate stretching and taking the muscles and taking your ligaments beyond the range that riding allows, that creates strain over your joints, which ends up being counterproductive to good posture and efficient movement.
Hmm.
Of course, the more experienced a rider you are, the more you can work with your horses using shorthand and kind of compensate and get around for less ability in your body, but it's still there. And I've seen quite a lot of professional riders who, after decades of riding, end up creating repetitive strain issues because...
Like, give me an example.
Well, hip flexors, for
oh.
example, and sciatica.
Yeah.
I see a lot of sciatica because of tightening of the hip flexors in the riding position and in the seated position we use for driving and desk work and most of our modern life doesn't allow the piriformis or the gluteal muscles doesn't allow them to properly develop. So what you end up with is sort of a long-term sprain happening created
I couldn't hear that. A long-term...
Sprain created
sprain.
From tightness on the front of your hips.
Wow.
Pulling the back of your hips forward, and the sciatic nerve runs through the piriformis muscle, which when it becomes overstrained can create sciatic pain.
Hmm.
So that's one example. Another example I've seen is groin injury or groin area
I had
pain
that.
From tightness.
Right.
Yeah.
So what can you do about that?
Well, that in particular, and because it's such a common problem, I really encourage stretching the hip flexor area. But stretching isn't enough because as you ride, the strength of your muscles pulls your body into its default patterns, the firing patterns. So stretching is the start, but then you need to develop strength in the side that's not getting used as much riding. So for a rider, for a dressage rider in particular, that would be kind of the back half. Your gluteals, the back of your legs. So it's nice to be able to cross-train off the horse doing work to build up the gluteal muscles, even though you'll never clench them, you'll never really use them, and you'll never bring your leg back very far when you're riding, but it's precisely because of that that you need to build the strength off the horse.
Mm-hmm. So you're balanced.
Yeah, it's more a structural balance,
right?
I guess. Yeah.
So that we naturally have opposing muscles if we don't do other stuff that are stronger, and that's what I'm just asking you this, I don't know this for sure, so that because we have stronger muscles and then the opposing muscles are weaker, we set ourselves up for injury or strain. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I'm saying. And
well,
the other
and one,
thing that can...
I'm oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, there's another common tight... similar issue with antagonist and agonist or opposing muscle groups that I see, and that's with the inner and outer thigh.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't generally go around riding lifting our legs 3 feet out from the
horse. Yeah.
the squeezing and the leg aids are all within probably 15 degrees at most of movement
right.
of the leg.
Mm-hmm.
So we develop a great deal of strength in a very short range.
Mm.
And this creates a kind of an uneven strength in the muscles that are involved. So as soon as they're out of the range for any reason, like slipping, walking around the barn on ice or something
mm-hmm.
like that, you're much more prone to injury. But also it creates a kind of an imbalanced tightness across the hip joint and across the knee joint. So strengthening the outside of your leg for the same reasons is also another area that I often end up working with.
Mm-hmm. I just want to get back to something that you said earlier about stretching. I'm probably doing this wrong, but because I always stretch before I ride because I did have a groin injury, but people always tell you not to stretch cold muscles, that you should stretch warm muscles, and so that you should stretch after you've exercised. What's your feeling on when to stretch and what's the correct way to stretch? Because I know you're not supposed to bounce or anything like that.
You're absolutely right. And you have a very good point. You are not supposed to push into a stretch and hold it when your muscles are cold. When in doubt, I try to my best to refer to other sport conditioning and best practices in sport conditioning generally. And the practice that's in use right now is to use a dynamic or flowing motion, stretching motion. So you gently go into the stretch and come out of it in sort of a dynamic and rhythmic way, which is
also you never hold it.
No, not before you ride.
Yeah.
In and out, in and out.
Hmm.
And then after you ride, you might want to hold a pose or hold a stretch for a longer period of time. And as you pointed out, it's counterindicated now to bounce because when you bounce in a stretch, you're actually stimulating the muscle to contract.
Right.
And you're trying to lengthen the fibers, but you're stimulating them to contract. So you're more prone for tear if you bounce.
And also, one thing that I learned, you know, like I said, having been around for a while and having had injuries, I learned as far as stretching, and it's similar to what you were saying about contraction afterwards, that when you do stretch, just stretch to the point that you're starting to feel it. If you overstretch, then when you're done, it is going to contract back and everything you've done is counterproductive. So it's not like this big, when you're doing, I guess the word is, static, since you talked about dynamic stretches before you ride, if you're doing just stationary or static stretches afterwards to not overstretch, is there any kind of gauge that you could give people about when they're at the point that they should hold the stretch and don't go any further and how many seconds they should hold it for?
Yes, absolutely. Good stretching technique is, I think, exemplified by yoga. So if anyone out there has done some yoga, then they'll have learned some good stretching technique. And I use the technique anytime I'm stretching with anyone, whether it's a yoga pose or not. And the key is to use your breathing to relax your body. The more you use your breathing to relax your body, the more it becomes psychologically a faster signal to your body to relax. So you can use it when you're riding, too. There's a side benefit. But to use your breathing and to go into a stretch till you just feel it and then wait. And typically it's about 30 seconds or more because the muscle's first initial reaction is to contract as if, for example, you were walking and you slipped on some ice, your muscles will contract immediately. So your muscles don't know that you're stretching and not slipping. So their first reaction is contraction. So you wait until that's finished and the muscle relaxes a little bit. And then you can push into it a little bit further. And what I'll often suggest to people is to think about looking for an extra millimeter. But an extra millimeter a day is a lot of inches after a short period of time.
And how do you, when you say coordinate that with your breathing, are you starting the stretch and inhaling as you're starting the stretch and then exhaling while you're holding the stretch? How do you coordinate it with your breathing?
I start the stretch with a deep inhale, so inhaling into your diaphragm, expanding your stomach, and when I say deep, I mean 10 or 15 counts of inhaling breath and letting it out, and then going through 4 or 5 breath cycles like that, and usually by then you'll feel the muscle give.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Very good.
Yeah.
So you're saying We do the dynamic, gentle, in-motion stretches before we ride, then we ride, and we can do some of the more stationary stretches where we're holding it for 30 seconds or so and breathing several times during that. Did I get that right?
That's correct. The only exception would be if you're riding multiple horses. My suggestion is to continue to use a little dynamic stretching in between the horses.
Right.
So that each subsequent horse doesn't get you tighter and tenser, depending on how your ride went.
Yeah.
That's the only case when I would suggest otherwise. Also, I have worked with a number of people with arthritis or fibromyalgia or MS or cerebral palsy, and the dynamic stretching is really, really excellent for stimulating neuromuscular connection without strain. So their whole workout is that's it. That's almost it, dynamic stretching, to help the neuromuscular connection and to ease circulation and to warm up the joints. Very useful before riding and after.
You know, I just got an email yesterday, actually, from someone who was distressed because she has rheumatoid arthritis, which is really a crippling arthritis. Would that type of dynamic stretching help someone with a problem like that as well as the other ones you mentioned?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And with any joint issues and general inflammation, I find it's not really a good idea to train to the point of exhaustion. It tends to be counterproductive. So to always stay behind that line, perhaps a little more than somebody who doesn't have a condition like that.
Yeah. So that's a case where no pain, no gain is not the right way to go.
That's right.
Yeah. Probably that's not the right way to go anymore anyhow. Back in the Jane Fonda days it was, but how do you feel about the no pain, no gain mantra?
It sort of depends on your age. I noticed that anyone I work with under 35, when they have a pain, it's usually a muscle tear. And anyone over 40, when they have a pain, it's usually more at the ligament end, and it's just because of with age, your ligaments aren't as they don't have as much give as they used to. So it seems that weakness transfers much faster into the ligament, into the joint. So when you're exercising, if you feel any pain, a sharp pain or any kind of a burning pain right inside the joint, or you feel almost it feels like where the muscle attaches, that's a negative amount of stress load to be putting on your muscles. You may get that from being over exuberant with the number of repetitions that you're doing of your exercise, or with weight load if you're training with weights, or because of insufficient cardiovascular conditioning to provide enough oxygen. However, if you're training and you feel burning right in a muscle, and it's the muscle itself that feels like it's working until the point of shaking, but it's not tearing at either end, then what you're doing is creating micro tears in the muscle fiber, and that's what creates muscle growth, which is really important to do. So there's a line you want to get to that you don't want to cross too much, but you don't want to stay too far back either if you're a normal, healthy person. Never to be afraid of overworking. Usually if you're doing an exercise for a large number of repetitions, that's an endurance set. So you don't have to be afraid of working to the maximum or using the most weight that you can use to push yourself a little bit. What you really don't want to do is waste your time by doing too light a workout that's effectively burning a few calories but not really building any muscle tone.
So how can you tell what kinds of exercise would be good for an individual when their main focus is getting fit for riding?
It really depends on the individual. It depends on the type of activity they enjoy and what they may already be involved in. Let's take a rider who might be going to a Pilates class once or twice a week. That's doing some very good core work and some good strength work. Depending on their involvement in their riding, they may need to do additional strength work for certain areas. And additional cardiovascular work, because if you're strong and you're aware and your core is engaged but you still run out of oxygen, you'll still fatigue and you'll still break down and you won't be able to maintain the posture that the Pilates was helping you be aware of
mm-hmm.
and conditioned for. So that's one example. It sort of depends on what's lacking based on what's already in your week.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I just think of what I have done over the years just because I didn't know any better. But I always thought, okay, and you please correct me if I'm on the wrong track here, but what I've always done is I thought, okay, I have to work out in three different areas. I have to maintain my flexibility, I have to strength train, and I have to do cardio. So, like I said, I would stretch, you know, every day. Anyhow, that's just an everyday thing, the stretching. And then the cardio, and at this stage of my life, it's mostly power walking because my knees don't want to jog. But, they, you know, when I was younger, I would alternate power walking with, you know, little short sprints of jogging and then back to power walking. And then just weight training. So I would think of it as a three-pronged kind of thing so that I was covering the flexibility, the strength, and the cardio. I don't know if that's old school or, you know, you think that's a good idea or you have something to add to that.
Oh, not at all. I would just flesh that out a little bit. These days I talk about a training scale for fitness because it's the concept most dressage riders
right.
can understand that you don't progress to later things without also still doing what was lower down the training scale.
So many things in your training scale?
Well, I don't know that I've added them all up. When I get to the top,
there's
a lot of little details. But down at the bottom is the flexibility, the everyday stretching habit.
Yeah.
So when I'm at a clinic, for example, I'll say to people, look, if it's all new to you and the first thing you do and the only thing you do for the next 2 months is just remember to stretch every day before you ride, that is going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got that down and you want to continue, build core strength. And core, a lot of people just think about the abdominals. I'm just about to release an ebook, actually, a core workout for riders.
Cool.
A lot of people just think about the abdominals, but you really have to think all the way around, like a tree trunk, because
mm-hmm.
that's what supports your spine and your hips.
Mm.
It's not just a six-pack on the front. And your back is really important, and I find a lot of riders forget their back. They're very focused on the abs, but forgetting that it's your back, actually, that keeps you upright. So core work is like a foundation. If your muscles in your limbs and your limbs attach at your torso, and the strength that the rest of your body has really comes from the core. So if, for example, you think about leaping in the air while standing on a marshmallow, you won't get very far.
Right.
So if that marshmallow is your core, that's how much it's reducing the impact of your leg aids or your shoulders. But if you are on a hard surface and you jump in the air, you have a lot more power. So it's kind of the same effect that a strong core has for the rest of your body. So that's the next layer up.
And you can train. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some examples of, like you say, okay, don't just think of your abdominals, think of your back, that whole band around there. Can you give an example of, for, like, an exercise for each?
Yep. So when you're thinking about your own home core workout, and by the way, you could probably be extremely effective 3 times a week with about 5 or 10 minutes each
time. Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
Yeah. It's not long. It's really very little and cheap and no equipment.
Yeah. Ooh, even better.
So sit-ups, nobody really does sit-ups anymore because halfway up you stop actually using the abdominal muscles to begin with so that you lose some value. So we do crunches or we use the exercise balls for that. Anything with a twist starts to incorporate your obliques at your waist, which are responsible for position of your hips. You know, people think about the obliques, you know, supporting your ribs, but they also attach at the top of your hips. So if you have a rider that tends to sit left or their left cheek falls down a little bit to the left, the ability to readjust their hips and pick up one seat bone is very much part of the oblique strength. So obliques, so anything with a twist or a side crunch type of motion will work your obliques.
But you should shouldn't you keep like your knees bent while you do any of those so that you don't hurt your back, or is that also old school?
No, you should. You don't have to if you're very, very strong,
mm-hmm.
but you're better to if it will keep your lower back flat on the floor.
Mm.
You don't want any anterior or forward tilting pelvis. You don't want any dip happening in the small of your back when you're
mm-hmm.
doing work.
If you're lying down, bend your knees, and as you do the crunch, come up about how far?
Now, a really simple routine would be laying on your back with your knees bent, as you said, with just like you were about to do sit-ups. And instead of doing sit-ups, do 20 or 30 simple crunches, and that would be lifting your shoulder blades and head off the floor.
That's
pressing
all.
Your stomach into the floor.
Yeah.
But with abdominal work and any core work, it's not really so much about how far you move your body as how strongly you do it.
Hmm.
So I'll often say to clients, the only one who knows that you're doing 100% is you.
Mm.
From the outside, you can't really see it. But
mm-hmm.
you want to squeeze, you want to find the relevant muscle and squeeze and wring the heck out of it as hard as you can. That's how to get the benefit out of your core work without having to do 600 repetitions.
Right.
So
does it matter if your arms are like crossed over your chest or should they be behind your head? Because I've seen it both ways.
Well, if they're crossed over your chest, that's easier. If
mm-hmm.
you put them up by your ears, like a sit-up position, that
mm-hmm.
that adds more weight further down, so that's harder.
Mm-hmm.
If you put them right up overhead, that's even harder. So you could do whatever level of progression you're
I
at.
See.
Now, you could take that simple exercise and simply incorporate a twist now, bringing your elbow, let's just say your right elbow, crossing your body and sending it toward your left knee. So now you're doing a crossing your body motion with the
mm-hmm.
crunch. That's incorporating your obliques.
Mm.
Now you could also go back to your basic crunch and bring your knees in and feet up off the floor each time you crunch and put your feet back down on the floor in between,
yeah.
and that gets to your lower abdominals. And so far we haven't left the crunch.
Mm.
You could then, after those three things, you could flip over on your stomach and do Supermans, which are lifting your arms and legs are straight out.
Yeah, I couldn't hear that real well.
Lift them off the floor.
Tell
Supermans.
Me. Superman. So
yeah.
Explain
you're lying
it again because I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're lying on the floor with your arms straight out
mm-hmm.
and your legs behind you, and you just lift them up off the floor.
Like
at
you're flying.
The same time.
Yep. Okay.
And you can also swim them as well. That's a really good exercise for the low and middle back. So there's
great.
Four exercises you could do in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Very, very easily.
Love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's a big complaint that a lot of people have. You know, I'm busy. Excuse me. I don't have time to go to the gym or whatever. You know, how do I fit some kind of fitness program into my busy life? So I love that, you know, takes such a short amount of time for such a important part of your training scale when you're really close to the base. You said the flexibility was first and the core work was next. So that's a really good start that isn't particularly time-consuming.
Not at all. And the stretching especially, you can fit in here, there, and everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the core work, you don't even have to be dressed in exercise gear. You don't even need to take time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I often suggest that people fit it in right when they get home from the barn and they're still sweaty and they're in flexible clothing,
mm-hmm.
do their core work then.
Right.
So it even saves time, how many times a day you change and shower, for example.
Right.
Something simple like that.
Yeah. Just
after
being efficient
that,
with your time.
Yeah. Yeah. After that, the minimum amount of time you need to strength train a muscle group is twice a week.
Okay.
So that's not very much. Some busy riders, you might be able to do a complete body strength workout, a little light one, but efficiently within about 20 minutes twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as maintaining and building cardiovascular condition goes, you really just need about 10 to 15 minutes twice a week. That's a bare minimum, mind
mm-hmm.
you, to improve your cardiovascular ability. Now, if
you
also, if you're quite, if it's quite low or weight loss is also a goal, you need to work out more often than that, but you can make significant improvements. And I always encourage people to think about working efficiently. Now, when you're doing cardiovascular work, you really don't want your horse to be your cardiovascular workout. And I'm sure you've seen a rider that's not in as good cardiovascular shape as they could be. It's wearing on the horse because
mm-hmm.
they start fatiguing, and you don't want to use your horse for that. For fun, sometimes I've strapped a heart rate monitor on and noticed that it doesn't really get into the improvement zone unless things aren't going well in the ride. So that's interesting to note.
What's the improvement zone?
For most adults, that would be somewhere between about 125 and 160 beats per minute. And effectively, if you don't have a heart rate monitor, the rule of thumb is to remember that you're in the improvement zone if you have to breathe through your mouth. But you don't have to be wheezing. But if you're at that pace where you must breathe through your mouth, that's improvement zone.
Huh.
So that's really all you have to remember. And as you mentioned, you don't need to run. You can power walk, you can swim, you can bike, you can add intensity to a walk just by going up and down a hill
mm-hmm.
without ever having to break into a run.
Hmm. Cool. I'm surprised that I realize that probably longer is better, but I was really surprised to hear you say even 10 to 15 minutes for cardio twice a week is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was like 30 minutes three times a week.
Well, that would be better. But,
yeah.
You know, let's say it's show season, and you need to do something, but you only have so much time. Well, 10
mm-hmm.
to 15 minutes will see some improvement.
Yeah. You know what? I think that's such a good thing, all of these things. You know, you talk about adding the flexibility stuff through your day and how quickly you can do the core work and the strength training just twice a week and the cardio minimum, you know, 10 minutes twice a week. I think what's good about that kind of program is that, you know, a lot of times people are given, you know, they say, okay, I'm going to get on this fitness regime, and they go to the gym and they work with a trainer and they tell them, okay, you've got to do this and you've got to do that. And it's so overwhelming, time consuming, that they end up doing nothing. And so
that's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so to feel that you can still make improvements doing things just on a small scale like that and weaving it through your day, I think is encouraging to people that they feel like they don't have to eat the whole elephant at once.
Absolutely. Especially if you live in a more rural area or you have your own farm or your riding and work and other life schedule is such that, you know, driving to a gym, working out for an hour and driving home and
mm-hmm.
taking the 2 or 3 hours that takes three times a week is just
not
going to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
And then I think at the top of the training scale of my training scale of fitness is the finer tuned work. So this would be more body awareness type work. You can't recruit muscles that aren't there, so you need to get in touch with them lower down. But then if the rider has, you know, a particular issue like difficulty turning their shoulder girdle to the right, we'll say, effectively for lateral work. They might want to spend a little more time working specifically on a specific area like that, building strength, building rotational strength, a little more time on flexibility in that area so that it becomes easier.
So that's what you mean by finer tune, zeroing in on certain areas?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Different kinds of exercises like you were mentioning Pilates.
Yeah. Now, when the great thing about getting fit and cross training is there's not a magic workout for all riders that all riders must do that if they did that, they would all be better. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
work like that. But there's also very few activities that don't fit in as good puzzle pieces in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So that leaves a lot of variety open. So if somebody enjoys cycling, that can be your cardio can be cycling, whereas somebody else's can be the power walking, depending
mm-hmm.
what they like. Things to keep in mind always, though, are that in riding is like dance, and we're trying always to achieve more and more symmetry. We're born asymmetrical, and we're trying to overcome that all our lives. So we don't want to spend significant amount of time doing asymmetrical sports. And unfortunately for some, that means golf or tennis, and you may enjoy those, but you, if you're serious about your riding and you don't want your sport activities to have a negative impact on your riding ability, then you need to minimize those.
But it isn't something like cycling, although it's good cardio, isn't that an asymmetrical kind of thing because you're mostly using, what's the front of your leg called? Is that your quads? No.
Your quadricep and hamstring are fairly evenly used.
Cycling. In cycling?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I have some riders, though, they've got fitted boots, for example, expensive fitted boots, and so they said, I don't want bigger calves.
Mm-hmm.
The way to avoid bigger calves when cycling is just, it's related to the way you pump the pedals when you're going up hills. So you could build huge calves or you could minimize that depending on what you're doing.
Cool. And so, you know, we're talking about, you know, strength training and cardio and all this other stuff. And, you know, you mentioned asymmetrical, and we're always trying to become symmetrical, and that's also an issue for our horses because most of them that I've ever run across are asymmetrical, having a strong side and a weak side. But talk about, unless you, this is part of your training scale here, about balance and how you improve your balance, because with the horses and riding, it's all about balance.
Oh, that is a great topic, and it's actually one of the hottest topics in fitness training right now. All the conferences I go to, they've got lectures on balance, because everybody wants to use the wobble boards and the balance boards and the Bosu balls. I don't know if you've seen those half balls, and so balance training is the big key. There are a lot of factors involved in balance, and it seems to get more difficult as we age, and balance, luckily, is something you can learn to be better at. Some people think, oh, I don't have good balance. I wasn't born with it. It is actually a skill you can acquire or improve. Some people have phenomenal balance. You know, I mean, those will become ballerinas and skaters and so on. But you have what you have to work with, but you can improve from where you're at. And a number of the different factors are things like your mental attention. So mentally, if you're stressed or scattered, it reduces your ability to center physically and to find balance. If you have a head cold, because your ears are involved in balance, your eardrums, so that can throw you off. Sort of on a more general scale, when I'm working with people who don't have very good balance to start off with, we'll start with basic core strength. So I won't put them on a balance board yet. Mm-hmm. I'll work on their core
strength.
What's
a balance board? I know what the Bosu or however you say that is, but I don't know.
A balance board is a piece of board about 2 feet wide with, I would say, about a 2x2 down the middle of it, and they have variations on the theme. But the idea is that you can rock from left to right. Whereas a wobble board generally is round, and it has a round button under it, which can rock you in 360 degrees.
Oh.
And as a rider, I don't use those a lot with my riding clients because on the horse, you're not so concerned about all the other 350 degrees. You're really concerned with left-right balance in your stirrup. So I use a balance board more often.
Cool.
And you can... the balance starts with your core stability because, as we talked about earlier, your core muscles support your hips. And one thing that a lot of people will do is they'll hunch their shoulders up to their ears, and that changes their center of gravity and makes balance more difficult. So somebody with poor balance could pay attention to where their shoulders are and think of bringing their shoulders down their back like they should anyway. Engaging their core, and after that, work on stabilizing exercises like standing on one foot or progressing to squatting on one foot, up and down, bending one knee.
That's
you know? Or exercises that I'll do in a clinic situation is I'll either have a balance board with me or, you know, if I've flown somewhere, I can't carry all that, so I bring tennis balls. And have people stand with their legs about horse width apart on tennis balls. Now, it puts them in a little bit of a two-point position.
Yeah.
But if you can stand on two tennis balls and lift your heels off the floor for a few moments, that really helps.
Oh, I'm going to try that.
Yeah, and little things, yeah, vary. It's very easy to work on balance. You can use a pool noodle and stand on that with the
what
ball
is
in
that?
Your feet. A pool
what's
noodle?
A, yeah.
It's, you know, those long foamy
oh, yeah,
things
yeah.
for
yeah.
pools. So
oh,
you,
yeah.
you just put that on the floor and you stand on that. And that can help too. So you can sort of start to train balance just with practice.
Yeah, you know, one of the things you said about balance and focus, I haven't done this in a little while, but and you'll have to, I know I'm pronouncing this wrong, what's that thing called, that half circle, Bosu?
Bosu.
How do you spell that?
B-O-S-U.
Oh, B-O-S-U, yeah. I remember working with somebody on one of those and just doing some simple things and then actually sort of jumping around on it. But if I was unfocused, I would lose my balance and fall off. And if I just kept my mind sort of on my belly button, on my center, a la Sally Swift-like, then I could pretty much do anything. But I had to have a focal point. And when I had a focal point that I made up, she didn't tell me to focus on that, I just did it. But when I focused on that, I was able to do whatever I needed to do, whether it was jumping on and off of the thing or side to side or whatever. And as soon as I didn't have my mind into that point in my core, I guess I'm sure I'm using these words incorrectly, then I would lose my balance. So I understand completely what you're saying when you say focus is such an important part of balance.
And you're not using terms incorrectly at all.
I'm not.
Absolutely. No, when I'm working with someone
here's the
on a
layman.
A BOSU, I will tell them to focus on their belly button.
Oh, really? Isn't that funny?
Or to put their weight in their hips.
Huh.
Yeah. Now, another thing, on a horse, of course, balance on a balance board is one thing. Balance sitting on a moving horse is another, because you're not actually standing in the stirrups. You're seated. I find balance is very much affected by general flexibility. So if people are stiff in the hips or stiff in the spine or stiff in the knees or stiff in the ankles, those areas are blocking the ability of their body to absorb the motion of the horse.
Mm-hmm.
So it jolts and jars them, so they lose their balance. So this is, again, where flexibility becomes something really important.
Yeah, you know what that made me think of while you were describing that? I was picturing someone who is at our barn, and, you know, she's 67, 68 years old, and not particularly flexible. And she has had some falls, and she's had some falls because her horse will spook at something, and she's not flexible enough to go with him. Whereas looking at the spook that happened, I know that, you know, 90% of the people that are at the barn would just go with, that follow along. They'd absorb, like you say, the motion so that they wouldn't lose their balance and fall off, which she has.
Had her spine wiggled sideways to follow the horse, or
right.
had it corkscrewed to keep up with the horse,
yeah.
she would have stayed on. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So that's really important for people to understand. The importance of the flexibility when people, you know, you put that at the bottom of your training scale. I mean, that just occurred to me as you were saying that. But the importance of the training scale, and you put that at the base of your training scale, and I do, you know, a lot of people, I'm getting ready to put out this program, Freedom from Fear, and one of the things is, you know, dealing with a horse that's shying or spooking or bolting or whatever, and that's an interesting aspect of it that I hadn't considered, the flexibility of the rider, making it something that you can cope with more easily than if you're not flexible.
Absolutely. I've often noticed when somebody says to me, I'm afraid to canter, I'm just walking and trotting right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I'll lose my balance. And I look at them in their walk and trot, and their ankles are stiff, and their knees are stiff, and their legs are stiff, and their hips are squeezed, so their seat is pushed up out of the saddle, and so their body tips forward or flies backward, depending what the horse is doing. And I don't tell them, but I kind of agree. I think, well, absolutely, don't you canter. I would be scared too. Wait until you can sit comfortably and feel more confident in yourself. And since you're on the psychological aspect of it, it's really interesting to notice that as people are doing groundwork, training their body and using different forms of exercise and becoming much more aware of where your body parts are and where the muscles are and how they work and how to use them and how to use one with not without also clenching another that you didn't intend to. They get more confident.
Yes.
They get more physically confident, and it transfers right away onto their ride as well. So not just the physical flexibility, but the mental confidence and sense of if somebody's having a hard time understanding and feeling center of gravity sitting on the horse, most of the time in a clinic situation, I'll notice they also have a little bit of difficulty standing on the ground.
Hmm.
I mean, not that they can't stand, but that if I ask them to do something mechanically, biomechanically, they're off their center of gravity.
Hmm.
So if we work on that on the ground, then they get a better sense for where it is. It transfers back into the saddle and helps them balance better.
Hmm. You know, that also what you're saying made me think, and you mentioned this earlier about balance and you know, if you have a cold, that can affect you and blah, blah, blah. And then tying this all into what you just said about confidence, it occurred to me just unconsciously that if I've been sick and so I don't feel very strong, or if I'm exhausted because I've just had a big long trip and I have jet lag and then I try to ride the next day, I don't put myself in a position where I'm going to have to deal with a bronchi horse or something like that, because I don't feel I have control over my balance and my body, either because of the jet lag or because of not having my balance because I have a cold or something like that. And so rather than, I hadn't actually thought of it as lack of confidence, but I actually, you know, pull back a little bit from what I would do the next day when I feel strong and I feel in control of my body. So I, you know, as I'm listening to you talk, I see how all of those things are tied together. The lack of balance if you're sick or you're jet lagged, and not having confidence, all of those things. And so therefore, when you are feeling stronger and more in control of your body, of course you're going to feel more confident. That's great. I love how all of those things are tied together.
And what you do when you scale back or control the situations you're in the day after jet lag, I would call that athletically responsible. Some people,
oh, that's a nice way to put it.
Well, yeah. Some people would call it, no, you must push yourself,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Huh. I disagree. I think that in physical training and in sport conditioning, yes, you're always pushing the envelope, but you're always doing so with an athletically responsible approach. So there are times you can take on more, and there are times it's wiser to peel back and break something down into steps that you can do and then add the steps back up together again.
Right. Excellent.
Along those lines, we were talking about cross-training activities that people might want to do besides their riding. Anyone that I work with that competes seriously is very, very careful about all cross-training. So, for example, you might be tempted to hike to the top of a mountain in Vermont for the weekend because you love hiking.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be very careful about pacing yourself or the size of mountain that you take, because you don't want to be not able to ride for 3 days.
Right.
Whereas somebody who doesn't ride, they might not care. So you can't kind of get drawn into extreme sports or extreme exertion that's going to put you in danger of not being able to ride.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I suggest people
and
draw
another
the line.
Another thing along those lines that I have always done when I'm gearing up to a big competition is, you know, I'll do my little three-pronged approach with my flexibility and my cardio and my strength training, but I don't do anything, period, except for maybe stretch, the day before the competition, because I want to go to the competition rested, which is sort of what you were saying about hiking to the top of the mountain. I don't want to go into the competition in an exhausted state. I want to go in a state of recovery. What's your feeling about that?
Oh, that's excellent. And in any other sport, that's pretty much what an athlete will do. I have some clients that run marathons, and they'll train, and their training will ramp up over 6 months
mm-hmm.
until they're running 30 kilometers. What would that be? 20 miles, I guess,
on
their weekend run.
I'm not metric.
We'll say, so they're running 2-3 hours once a week, and they're running an hour or two. So they're running really hard, and they're training really hard.
Yes.
But in the 2 weeks prior to competition, that drops right off.
For two whole weeks?
And they don't cut it out completely, but they start to scale back. And then
wow.
the days right before a run, they rest.
Hmm.
They might do very, very light walk or very light jog or some additional core work, but nothing strenuous. And part of it is there's a lot of physical things going on. And I don't think a lot of people really realize that in an athlete's training schedule, rest is just as important
yeah.
as the workout. So a periodized training plan includes even sometimes a whole week of relative leisure every once in a while after several months of intense activity.
Mm.
And within each week, hopefully a day when you have almost complete rest.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I do it with my horse. For example, whenever it's the day before either a day off or a hack day, which is, you know, basically a rest day, that day before the hack day and the rest day is the hardest day that I have. So I stress the muscles the most that I would do in the week, knowing that the next day is a recovery day for the horses.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Now, it also depends on the way someone's mind works in competition. You don't want your body completely fatigued because you need energy stores in your muscles to call on those
mm-hmm.
when you're riding, and you need mental focus. But if you're, let's say, you're a very nervous, hyper A-type kind of a person, and the closer you get to a horse show, the more keyed up you get.
Yeah.
And someone like you has hours and hours of competitive time under their belt. You've developed mechanisms to handle it. An amateur rider competitor like myself doesn't have those hours, so they're just still getting keyed up before.
Yeah, I didn't consider that aspect of it. Yeah.
Somebody who that happens for, they might want to consider going for a really long walk or a good jog the day before or the 48 hours before,
yeah.
just to get some of that fast twitch. It's actual physical. You have fast twitch and slow twitch muscles, and hotter
mm-hmm.
horses have more fast twitch, and people are the same, I've noticed. Some people are fast twitch oriented, and they're hot, and other people
mm-hmm.
aren't. And the ones
mm-hmm.
that are, sometimes you need to physically expend those chemicals so that the person can mentally be calm and focused. That's the way I work before a competition.
Yeah, that's great. I had never actually considered that. And the only reason I'm laughing is I remember when I first got this horse, some people might remember him. Some people on the call might remember him. His name was Jolicoeur, and he was a Tricaner. And, you know, they're hot horses because they have a lot of thoroughbred blood in them.
Yeah.
And I'm very fast twitch. And so when I move, I mean, you've seen me at the clinic. When I move, I'm always walking fast, doing things fast. You know, I'm just a fast twitch kind of person. And in the beginning, this poor horse, like I'd be working around him in the cross ties brushing and doing all these things. And he was like, you know, he was just like on guard, because here's this, you know, little white tornado moving around him. And somebody said something to me about, you know, just slow down when you move around him. And I'm like, you know what? This is me. This is the way I move. And he's just going to get desensitized to it. And he's going to get used to me, which he did, of course. But I definitely am a fast twitch type person. However, like you said, the reason that I can go into a competition in a state of recovery, in a state of rest, is only because I have the hours and hours and hours of experience competing, so the competition itself doesn't make me nervous.
Now, it brings up, yeah, and a lot of people don't have that and need to develop.
Yeah, to blow off steam a little bit.
Deliberately. Yeah, exactly. It brings up an interesting point about timing of exercise. I often get asked, oh, I've heard morning is best. Or evening, but I like to exercise when I get home in the evening. What time is best? My answer is usually the time that works for you and that
right.
you're going to be consistent is best.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'll be working with an individual and we'll really look at their week. We'll make a micro plan, and by that I mean this person might have a highly responsible job, and by 3-4 o'clock in the day, and they left home at 6 in the morning, went to their job, and now they're on the way back to the barn. They might be keyed up to the ceiling from the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so as not to take that. So asking that person to kind of zen out and do some yoga poses, their mind just can't enter that space.
Right.
So with a person like that, sometimes I'll suggest that they do some really hard exertion, even if it's just for 20 minutes for their own workout, then stretch, then go talk to their horse and do their ride. Somebody else might work better with 30 minutes of a peaceful walk and some stretching and then get on their horse. Somebody else might be just fine to get on their horse and it works out better for them to do some workout after their ride. It really depends on the individual.
It's so much does you people really have to tailor their program. And this isn't so much about fitness, but it has to do with what you're saying about the mental side of all of it. I remember years and years ago, and this is still what I do, I like to have my horse, before I compete, ready and, groomed and braided at least an hour before I need to be. And I always, I plan backwards from when I have to get on and start my warm-up. I always pad in an extra 15 or 20 minutes because I take that 15 or 20 minutes. That's the only thing that would make me nervous in competition is to feel hurried, like a strap broke or something, and I have to quickly find something to replace it, blah, 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 and I'm running around like a maniac. That would make me nervous. So I pad in that extra time so that then I have that extra 15 or 20 minutes, and I sit in a chair, and I take a few deep breaths, and I just visualize my test. Now, that works for me. I need that time. I don't like to feel time crunch hurried as far as, oh, my God, if I don't get on right this second, my warm-up's going to be cut short. And I remember seeing, some people might know Ann Guptill from Connecticut. She was she rode in the Pan American Games. I forget what year it was. But anyhow, we were at some shows together in Florida many years ago, and she has a completely different style. And I would watch her. It would make me nervous to watch her because she wouldn't be completely dressed. She'd have her white breeches and everything on, but she'd have an apron on because she was still braiding her horse. And he still, he wasn't tacked up, obviously. She was still braiding him. She wasn't completely dressed. And I knew she had to get on in 10 or 15 minutes. But this kept her calm because she was busy right up until the moment that she had to get on so that she didn't have a lot of time to think. I'd rather be able to sit and zone out and go over my tests. So everybody has to tailor their program to their own personality, I think.
Very much. And that said, it just reminds me of another aspect, too, which is generally we're attracted to activities that are easier for us to do. But having done that for a decade or two, by default, you might have to push yourself into activities that aren't so easy. So I know a lot of riders that really don't want to do the cardiovascular work.
Yeah.
And really don't want to do the strength training. But you're losing muscle mass at about a half a pound a year after the age of 25.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So you want to be able to ride. I don't know. I'm planning on riding when I'm in my 80s.
Yeah, me too.
You want to. So you really want to sort of keep in mind that it's not for you. It's not because you love cardio. It's because you love your horse, and you don't want to fatigue and start throwing 20 pounds of your body weight more on his left side than his right. And I always come back to, when we get on our horse, he's not our gym. We started off with the question, doesn't riding keep me fit? Well, I hope your horse isn't your gym. I hope when you're riding that your job up there, at least the way I view it, is my job is to facilitate his learning experience and his gymnastics. I'm not going to sit on my horse to replace some pieces of equipment.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, so we, or at least my thinking of my riding is constantly trying to be less interfering while more directing to the horse. So everything that we do comes down to what I need, what you need, what the listener needs to be able to do that better. So if you're riding and you're getting out of breath, well, you know you need to do a little bit more cardiovascular work than you're doing. Then you might spend some time on that, and you might have flexibility under wraps, no problem. So the thing to add to your program might be a couple of power walks. Also, for dressage in particular, too, we don't actually have a lot of hip movement in the riding position. And with age anyway, our hips get tighter. I don't know if you've noticed an older person when they walk, their legs go, but their hips don't really go. So we have a vested interest in keeping the sacroiliac joint as flexible and mobile as possible because it absorbs motion of the horse in seated riding. So long, stretchy power walks really help with that.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you're obviously the expert. I'm not the expert. I've just been an athlete all my life, but I haven't. It isn't my field like it's your field, but I just want to mention a couple of things as you're talking that I have just incorporated, getting back to this whole idea of, ooh, I'm busy, you know, and this is just one more thing that I have to add to my day that I don't have time to do. A couple of things popped into my mind, and maybe this will help some people. As far as the cardio, like you said, don't if you're getting out of breath on your horse, you've got to do more cardio. So things that I think would help people or have helped me to make the cardio less of a chore and more enjoyable is to link it with something else that you would enjoy, such as going with your dog or listening to music or, you know, listening to inspiring audio tapes or going with a friend, you know, just something that, so you're not thinking, you know, you're not even aware that you're exercising because the time is going by because you're linking it with doing something else that you consider pleasurable. So that's one thing I do. Another thing that I do, just like you say, you can fit in the flexibility stuff throughout your day without even noticing it. One thing I do when I finally have some downtime and let's say, and the best way for me to zone out and get out of my fast twitch mode is to watch television. It's like a tranquilizer. But what I do is, like during the commercials, I'll get on the floor and I'll do a plank position or I'll do 15 push-ups. So I use the commercials, however long they are, 2 or 3 minutes. I'll have these little 2 or 3 minute blocks where I do something physical like that. So it's not like, oh, I've taken a whole hour and I've driven to the gym, like you said, and I've devoted this whole hour to doing it. I just add it in at 2 or 3 minutes at a time while the commercial's on.
That's a great idea. That's really a great way to fit it in.
Yeah.
And it really is, like you said, you need to make it enjoyable. I find we're on our own cases all the time for our jobs and for our ride, and it's hard to be on your own case 24/7,
right,
cracking the whip over yourself. So it really does need to be enjoyable. Actually, I confess, most of my cardio, I created this career where I have to lead other people through stuff.
Uh-huh. See, that's
so
great.
I have 6 to 10 other people who are depending on me to get out there and move my body so they can move theirs.
Yeah, so it's accountability. You used accountability. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep, for myself. Yeah. And I enjoy things on the weekends like cross-country skiing or hiking and stuff, and I'll go do that. But it's pretty rare that I make myself go run. I try to fit it in otherwise or as a social thing. Yep.
Yeah, that's great. So listen, Heather, we're just about out of time, and I want you to be able to tell people how they can contact you or find out more about what you do. I think I mentioned your website, but I know it has funny spelling, so maybe you could tell people.
Oh, absolutely. It's Equifit with 2 T's, not to be confused. There's Equifit with 1, which is a sport equipment company, but it's Equifit with 2 T's.com.
Okay.
EQUIFIT.com, and all my contact information is on there.
Is on that website. Cool.
Yeah.
Great.
And actually, I do have a newsletter as well that anyone can sign up for free.
Cool.
That has a fitness tip once a month that goes out.
Excellent. That's great. Well, thank you so much for spending this time. It really got me inspired. I think I have to go do something now.
Oh, that's great. I'm really happy. I really appreciate it, and it's been fun.
Okay. You take care.
Okay. Thank you, too, Jane.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.